Good morning, Mr. Bodger. Are you ready to proceed?
May it please the Court, my name is Joe Bodger from the Office of the Attorney General on behalf of the State of Nevada, the appellant in this matter. At this time, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We're here today because the District Court granted Chrysler's petition for judicial review, issuing Chrysler a refund of sales tax that was simply measured by an amount paid under the Lemon Law. The District Court's decision in this matter effectively rewrote the Nevada Lemon Law and the Nevada Sales and Use Tax statutes by granting a refund that is not statutorily authorized. Additionally, Chrysler cannot make such a claim as to the refund as it lacks standing under the Sales and Use Tax provisions, and it has not complied with the provisions of the Sales and Use Tax provisions, even if it had standing. First and foremost, the Lemon Law in this instance is a consumer protection law. It mandates that where a manufacturer places an item into the stream of commerce that does not conform to its express warranties, the manufacturer must remedy the situation by paying compensation equivalent to the amount of the sales price, sales and use tax, tax titles, and other license fees associated with the purchase.
But the law never contemplated that there would be a penalty, did it?
Absolutely not.
They're arguing that this is essentially a penalty.
Absolutely, Your Honor. This is in no way a penalty. It is simply compensatory in nature. There have been a number of cases on this very same fact pattern that have held the payment of tax title and license fees, which reduced the amount that Chrysler would have received, do not constitute a penalty, but really are simply remuneration for the aggrieved customer. The Court of Indiana held very plainly that the payment of tax title and license fees in order to make the consumer whole is simply the teeth that give Lemon Law the effect. It does in no way make it punitive. Further, the Lemon Law, while it may not have contemplated such redress, is not intended to mitigate the damages or the compensation that the manufacturer pays pursuant to its terms. The Lemon Law is inherently a consumer protection law. It is inherently for the benefit of the consumer. It is designed to make the consumer whole after the purchase of a vehicle that has not conformed to its express warranty. Additional payments by Chrysler simply measured by tax title and license fees paid, are not to be mitigated under the sales or under the Lemon Law. Further, under the sales and use tax laws, Chrysler doesn't have standing to bring this claim as it does not meet the requirements of the general sales and use tax statutes. Further, even if it had standing, it wouldn't actually be able to demonstrate that it has satisfied the mandate of NRS 372630. That statute specifically requires that in order for a refund to be allowable, the amount paid must be over-collected, erroneously or illegally collected. That's the first prong. And then the second prong is that it be refunded to the person whom has collected the tax or by whom the tax was paid. In order to pay a tax, there must actually be remittance of money to the taxing authority. Here, Chrysler has in no way paid a tax to the state of Nevada. They have simply compensated an aggrieved customer, and the measure of the tax, or the measure of the compensation, simply mirrors that of the tax that was paid by the consumer to the retailer and ultimately remitted to the state of Nevada.
Is part of the state's concern here, Mr. Bodger, that if the refund was provided to the manufacturer, then either the consumer, who's now been reimbursed, or perhaps the dealer, makes a claim under the general sales tax refund statute and says, hey, we want our money back?
That is a concern.
I think the state would be at risk of having to pay it back twice.
That's exactly right. Additionally, the state would be able to essentially combat that by indicating that the tax is a tax, it's an excise tax. Sales and use tax in the state of Nevada is an excise tax. The difference between an excise tax and an income tax is important here. An excise tax is levied on a transaction, an event. It is simply measured by gross receipts. An income tax is levied on accession to wealth. So here, the transaction has not been disturbed. The transaction between the consumer and the retailer has still existed. The protections of that transaction offered by the state of Nevada under the sales and use tax statutes have not been disturbed in any way. The gross receipts reportable by the retailer are not affected by the amount of compensation paid under the lending law.
I may have misunderstood this, but I thought some cases had held that payment under the lending law constituted a rescission.
Absolutely.
In which case, the transaction has been rescinded.
And that's an excellent
point. Why shouldn't this court adopt that approach?
The cases that you're referring to primarily come out of the state of New York, and the use of the term rescission, I think, is simply an unfortunate term because the cases specifically are not dealing with sales and use tax. And then additionally, the one court that has used the term rescission in dealing with a sales and use tax case, that's the Daimler Chrysler decision out of Maine, have similarly concluded that there's no overpayment on different grounds, on grounds that Chrysler was not eligible for the refund as the person that had paid the tax. We can come back to that. But with regard to the actual rescission issue, there has not been a rescission. I think that that term is unfortunately used. The rescission must occur between the retailer and the consumer. And here, the actions are really, truly more of equitable restitution. It's an attempt to place the consumer in the place he would have been had the transaction not occurred. It doesn't eliminate the transaction. It doesn't change the gross receipts that the retailer receives or reports to the state of Nevada Department of Tax. It simply attempts to make whole the consumer who has been aggrieved by a lemon that Chrysler put into the stream of commerce. So in that sense, I think the term rescission is inartfully used, especially in cases that are not addressing sales and use tax transactions.
It's confusing to call it a rescission when they're not a party to the transaction.
That's exactly right. And that's why I feel that it is an inaccurate term of art that's being used, simply one that there was, I don't want to say there was no other term that the court could have used, but not having had the sales tax issue in front of them, it was not something that they considered. The Inuits have 100 words for snow. There are only so many words for equitable restitution, rescission, things of that nature. So I feel it truly is just an inaccurate term of art in those cases. Further, even if it was truly a rescission of the contract, Chrysler lacks standing under the sales and use tax statutes to actually apply for the refund. NRS 372.630 requires, as I indicated, both an overcollection or an erroneous payment, which in this case hasn't happened. The transaction occurred. The gross receipts from the sale were the measure. Those were remitted by the consumer to the dealer, who then remitted to the state of Nevada based on their gross receipts return. That has not been overcollected in any way. And the people that have paid the tax, the taxpayer, if you will, aka the people to whom the amount has been paid from and who have paid the tax pursuant to NRS 372.630, are not party to this transaction. Chrysler in no way fits that determination. Chrysler will attempt to differentiate this case from the case holding in the main Chrysler case by saying, oh, the main court used the term transaction as a defined term. That defined term in Maine was that the taxpayer is the person from whom the tax is received or by whom the tax is paid. Instead of defining it in a separate statutory section, the Nevada legislature has, in its wisdom, decided to simply leave that phrase within NRS 372.630. This case and that case are completely on all fours in that instance, in that they both define the person to whom a refund is eligible to be received from as a taxpayer. Chrysler,
the selling position is, had the legislature wanted to do this, they could have, as many other states have, giving either the taxpayer standing or allowing for the receipt of the refund from the tax department.
Yes, Your Honor. There are a myriad of states that have provided for a refund in this instance in one way or another. It's an entire spectrum of refund availability from states such as Maine and Nevada and Connecticut, which hold that no refund is available, to states such as California and Arizona and New York, who say either that the refund is available or that the refund is available but the customer must require or must request it, or the refund is available, but you have to pay it, and then you have to make a subsequent application. There are clearly methods for the legislature to have acted to place a refund into the statute. The legislature has not so acted, and in this state, when an act has been made and the legislature has decided to remain silent, that is an indication of the intention of the legislature, and here the intention is clear.
Is there any ambiguity?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe there is any ambiguity here because the statutory language for a sales and use tax refund is clear as to who is eligible, and Chrysler does not fit into that. Additionally, there is no ambiguity in the Linden law because they have specifically left it out. There is not even a provision with which you could argue ambiguity. There's no attack to be made. The walls have been put up, and they are ironclad by the legislature.
Mr. Bodger, before we reach your time for preserving a rebuttal, could you address a separate issue raised here, maybe not raised, and that's the effect of the July 2009 letter in rescinding the department's position on these refunds. If I understand correctly, you first questioned the right to raise this on appeal. I'd like you to talk about that. But assuming that the court addressed this point, I'd like you to talk about the merits of that issue.
Absolutely, Your Honor. As you point out, this issue was not addressed in the lower court. It was not properly reserved, and it has not been argued in any substantive way in the briefs. There is no analysis, citation, or any other grounds for this court to make a determination, and this court has, on a number of occasions, said if no analysis is presented, it does not need to rule on the issue. So first and foremost, we don't think it's appropriate or available. However, should you decide that you would like to rule on it, there is no issue to rule on. The issuance of tax notes, the quote-unquote rescission of the letter, is not a rulemaking. In order for there to be a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act, there must be a rulemaking under 233B.
Could you explain this letter process? You're distinguishing this then from NACs. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I'm distinguishing it from NACs, but also even from the Littlefield case, I'm distinguishing it from administrative orders or rules of general applicability. So first and foremost, there cannot be a rulemaking under 233B if there's not an administrative order or administrative action. The act of publishing tax notes is simply a convenience, a guide for taxpayers in the state of Nevada as to how the sales and use tax statutes and all of the tax statutes, to be honest, are applied. However, it does not create a determination of applicability as determined under 233B, and there is no general rule of applicability that's made by the department in this instance.
I'm concerned, though, that when the department puts out these newsletters and says we're going to interpret in this manner and then they change course, first, this does seem to have general applicability to all manufacturers faced with this subject. Is this a case where the court should say to the department, this looks like rulemaking to us?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree with that characterization, as it is clearly not rulemaking. There have been a number of courts that have held two fronts. One, that where there are not a substantial number of taxpayers concerned, there is no rule of general applicability. But then subsequently, a number of other courts have held that where the quote-unquote rule is simply putting the department back on course to actually adhere to the statutes as they're written, that is not a rule of applicability. It is simply conformity with the rules as they're written.
Mike, thank you, Mr. Bodger. Unless my colleagues have any questions at this point, we'll add 2 minutes to his time for his rebuttal. Thank you. And Mr. Larson, is it?
Yes, it is. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Larson, we'll add 2 minutes to your time in your argument if you need that time.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
This is your colleague.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ken Burns from the Colossal Law Firm in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Burns, how are you?
And my name is Peter Larson, and I appreciate the court allowing me to appear pro hoc vice today. I'm here on behalf of Appley Chrysler Group, LLC. I'd like to get straight to the statutory argument and the statutory authority for this refund. There is a two-step statutory analysis to determine whether Chrysler is eligible for this refund. The first step is under 372.630. We call that the refund statute, which is a general refund statute that authorizes a refund to the person who collected the tax or by whom it was paid. If collected the tax, certainly seems to me to be the dealer, the retailer, who made the sale, because they're the ones that collect the tax and turn it over to the state. So it's clear that the person who collects the tax is entitled to the refund, but then it says, or the person by whom it was paid. The department argues that by her, the person whom it was paid means the retailer and can only be the retailer. So if that's correct, what the statute says is there's a refund for the person who's the retailer or the retailer. But it doesn't say that. It says the person who collected the tax, meaning the retailer in this transaction.
But you're not the retailer.
We're not. We're the person who paid it. We're the person by whom it was paid. By whom it was paid, and the person who collected the tax was interpreted in the Oxbar case. And what it says about 372.630 is it says, when determining who paid the tax, we look to who bore the burden of the tax. And in that case, what they said was they said to the retailer who collected the tax, you're not entitled to this refund, even though you're the retailer, because it's your customer who bore the burden of the tax. Your customer overpaid the tax. So it's the customer who gets the refund. They are the person by whom it was paid. The bore the burden of the tax requirement in the case law looks over these two requirements and it ensures there is no risk of the double taxation that you asked about. There can't be double taxation in this case because the dealer can't get a refund. Under Oxbar, the dealer didn't bear the burden of the tax. The dealer merely collected the tax from the customer, remitted it to the department. The customer can't get the refund. The customer originally bore the burden of the tax, but the Lemon Law said, manufacturer, you must give that sales tax back to that customer. So the customer is whole. The only one left standing.
Whoa. There isn't any statutory provision, though, that talks about the right or prohibition on the part of the customer to seek the refund.
Absolutely. The customer would be entitled to the refund if it were not for the fact that they were made whole in this case. And that's how the mechanism works, and it all makes sense, and why there's no risk of double refund.
I appreciate the common sense point of your argument, but I don't see any statutory provision that prevents the customer from seeking a refund. Instead of the manufacturer or in addition to the manufacturer.
The customer would be entitled to it under the phrase the person by whom it was paid, but the Oxbar case says what that means is it has to be the person that bore the burden of the tax. So under the case law, interpreting that statute, the customer under these facts would not be entitled to the refund, but I absolutely agree with you that the customer would be entitled to the refund had the manufacturer not refunded the sales tax to the customer. That's what shifts the burden to the manufacturer, not the customer.
What if the Lemon Law is simply viewed as reimbursement to the customer and measuring their damages, and they throw in as part of that the tax paid? Isn't that an independent claim that the customer can make and is compensated by? It doesn't necessarily create a nexus between the sales tax you reimburse or their right to refund.
What it does is the customer absolutely has a right to reimbursement of the purchase price and the sales tax and the ancillary charges, but it's the fact of the reimbursement of that sales tax that prevents the customer from getting the refund, not by virtue of anything in the Lemon Law. It's just on the fact under the case law, the customer no longer has borne the burden of that tax. So the Lemon Law does indeed compensate the customer to rescind the transaction, statutory rescission, that puts the customer back in the position as if the sale had never occurred. And because they're in that position, they no longer have borne the burden of the tax. If the statute didn't read that way, then the or by whom it was paid would be completely superfluous. There would be no meaning to it, because it already says the person who collected the tax can get it. And the case law clearly points you to who bore the burden. And in this case, on these facts, it's clear only one person bore the burden. The logical intent of the legislature, as you said, it makes common sense. And what doesn't make common sense is that the legislature intended that the Department of Revenue would receive sales tax on a transaction that never occurred because it was canceled because Chrysler made a defective motor vehicle. That's not the case. It's not punitive, as you suggested. It's merely compensatory. And so the department's left holding the sales tax. And I agree with the department. Sales tax is statutory. Refunds are statutory. But there's express statutory
authority. Why couldn't the legislature make express provisions for a refund to a manufacturer, if it's so intended, as other jurisdictions certainly have done?
They could have, but they don't need to, because 630 specifically allows the person who collected the tax or the person by whom it was paid to recover.
What point?
When they reimburse the customer for the sales.
Or that.
When we look to 630 defines who is eligible for a refund, and as counsel correctly pointed out, there's a second step in the analysis, and it requires that the tax have been over-collected or erroneously computed. What the return merchandise statute does, 372.025, it specifically defines when you have an overpayment. And it says when a customer later comes back and returns that vehicle, now we have an overpayment.
So, counsel, extending your reasoning, what about this hypothetical? In a private party transaction, which results in a buyer suing the seller for fraud and rescinding the automobile transaction, do they get to succeed to the seller's claim to a refund of taxes if they paid it, simply because that was part of the damages that compensated for the rescission of the transaction?
In your example, if the customer is made whole for the purchase price and the sales tax, the customer no longer has the burden. Is no longer borne the burden, and there's no refund for the customer.
The defendant in that case, under your argument, would fit within the scope of this statute too and be able to make an application for a refund.
The retailer?
No, a private party transaction.
And I'm sorry, I'm not understanding the private party you're referring to.
The two private parties, seller and buyer, and the buyer sues for fraud, wants to rescind the transaction, and as part of the damages paid, reimburses the seller for any taxes the seller paid to the department. Under your theory, that buyer would succeed to the seller's position under the statute and could seek a refund from the department.
If the buyer has paid the tax to the retailer and is out the tax on a canceled transaction, absolutely. That customer would be entitled to a refund because it paid the tax on a canceled sale. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I believe if I submitted a refund claim to the department, they can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe they would honor that claim. I don't believe they actually dispute that. But to get back to your question about the later reimbursement, the return merchandise statute by definition looks at a later point in time. The department's whole brief says, well, you don't have an overhang because at the time of the sale, the correct amount of tax was paid on that sale. Well, that's the same situation you have when you have any return merchandise. What it says is when you return the merchandise, you reanalyze the gross proceeds at that point to determine whether there's an overpayment. Because if you didn't, you would never have an overpayment situation on return merchandise, because return merchandise necessarily happens after the fact. The statute calls for an after-the-fact adjustment to the proper amount of the gross receipts. If you didn't look at the results of the transaction, you would never have a refund for return merchandise. You'd never have a refund for a canceled sale. Clearly, if there's a canceled sale or return merchandise, the statutes contemplate a refund. But under the department's view, they say, nope, only look at the time of the original sale. We don't look at what happened later. But that's what the statutes necessarily require, is that we look at what happens down the line when the merchandise is returned. And the return merchandise statute applies to all tangible personal property. There's no exception for motor vehicles, and that's the law in Nevada under this statute. It's the law in almost every state. One of the things about the decisions in the other states that's a little bit misleading is that some legislatures did say, in their lemon law, they said, oh, by the way, you get a sales tax refund. And some of that is just superfluous. Some of that is because they weren't sure that the sales tax chapter was sufficiently clear to allow it. But in many other states, the Departments of Revenue specifically allow, under these same statutes, these general refund statutes and return merchandise statutes, allow the refund claims. The reason you see a couple of litigated cases on the issue is they're the few states that under return merchandise statutes and general refund statutes, without any specific provision in the Lemon Law, that contested this eligibility.
Well, why wouldn't the provisions of the Lemon Law, considering this is a general, the 372-630 is a general tax statute as opposed to a very specific statute indicated in the Lemon Laws, why shouldn't the Lemon Law statute prevail?
To me, there's no conflict. The Lemon Law specifically says the manufacturer must refund the statute, but there's already a complete body of sales tax law in Chapter 372 that governs all of sales tax. It governs the rights and remedies of everybody. And so, from a policy standpoint, I would not advise a legislature to put it in the Lemon Law, because if you did, then in a products liability case or some other case, you'd have sales tax provisions in other statutory chapters littered throughout the Nevada statutes. And that's why the better tax policy is to analyze the sales tax statutes. All the Lemon Law does is just says, in these facts, the transaction's canceled, everybody's put back in the situation they were, and the manufacturer must give the sales tax back to the customer.
Mr. Larson, how would, assuming the court were to agree with your suggestion, how would you formulate an opinion by this court that distinguishes the Connecticut Supreme Court's decision?
Well, in this case, there's very specific language in 630 that says the person who collected the tax or by whom it was paid. My first thing I would conclude, just as the district court did, is under the Oxbar case, it says by whom it was paid means the person who bore the burden. Under this particular set of facts, the person that bore the burden is the one who had to reimburse the sales tax to the customer under the statutes, which is Chrysler. And so, therefore, we are eligible under 630. Step two, was there an overpayment or erroneous collection? Not at the time of the original sale, but that's not when it's tested. 372.025 says you test it when the merchandise is returned. Here we had a full return of the merchandise, and so at that time it defines the gross receipts as having been overpaid, and therefore we have an eligible person who bore the burden of the tax, who paid the tax, and then we have an overpayment as defined by the return merchandise statute. So to me, it's a very simple statutory two-step analysis. As the ALJ and the district court found, it seems clear in the statutes, and we don't really need to resort to lots of rules of statutory construction, although we have several we cited in our brief that we think support our interpretation, one is which you're supposed to give meaning to the words in the statute, and the by whom it was paid would be written out of the statute if the department's view is confirmed. And secondly, we're supposed to attempt to achieve a logical and not an absurd result. And I don't know that anyone who's looked at this case so far has found the result to be illogical. I think the only argument is whether there's statutory authority under 630, which we think there clearly is.
Has any other state in the country adopted the analysis you just described?
Yes. Several states have done so at the administrative level. There are states that have done so.
In a reported decision.
In a reported decision, I don't believe so. There have been several unreported, but I know you're not allowed to rely on that in this courtroom, so we have not cited. But the there are many states that do it, and one of the reasons they do it, and a couple points I'd like to take with my remaining couple minutes, is this whole issue about whether Lemon Law is punitive or not. And the reason that that's important, we raise it as a rule of construction. The natural consequence, we're supposed to construe your statutes, obviously, to reach a logical result and also not to render them unconstitutional. The reason that the Lemon Law is constitutional is because it's not penal. The mandatory arbitration procedures required in the Lemon Law are not normally appealable by the manufacturer. And if you can't appeal a decision against you without due process in court, that's generally considered to be unconstitutional. And the only reason these provisions are constitutional is because the Supreme Courts of the various states have said there's no penalty involved here. And the reason that those states view their lemon laws themselves as being constitutional is because they don't believe there's a penalty, and almost all of them refund the sales tax so that there's not a penalty. In this case, if we have to pay a penalty of the sales tax, there's concern that there's risk to the constitutionality of the lemon law because we don't have a right to appeal the lemon law decisions, and we're paying a penalty without the right to go to court. Secondly, on the tax notes article, contrary to the department's brief, we're not arguing estoppel. What we're saying is agencies, when they adopt principles of widespread application, must go through rulemaking. And they
didn't overcome the department's point that this wasn't raised below.
Well, we've argued the state tax on this issue at every level. It's not been a key consideration in any of the decisions. But it's been, the state tax notes has been, articles and rescission has been introduced at every level and is part of the record on appeal. The whole point of the agency rulemaking process is so that there aren't unpromulgated agency rules. The whole point of the Administrative Procedure Act is so if you're going to publish something of widespread application and apply it for years, you're supposed to do it through the rulemaking process. And so the converse in the case law is that if you go ahead and skirt the rules and have this widespread de facto rule, it's called an unpromulgated agency rule. And once you do it, the way to undo it is through rulemaking. And as the department said, we didn't go through rulemaking to get rid of it. We just changed the state tax notes. That's not the way the agency is supposed to act with policies of general application.
Mr. Larson, I would request before you leave or as soon as possible, you file with the court a record designation of where the rulemaking argument was made before the district court and the administrative proceeding.
Absolutely. I would appreciate that, Your Honor, and thank you for the additional 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Burns. Mr. Bodger.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may quickly address a couple of points. Obexer is a great case for us because Obexer held expressly that the liability, the person whom has paid the tax, is the person that's required to make the refund request. And it further held that that person is the person who actually pays an amount that is then remitted to the Department of Taxation. CRESA doesn't fit that here. They're simply paying an amount of compensation pursuant to the lemon law. They have not paid a tax. They have not borne the economic burden of the tax. They've borne an economic burden associated with the lemon law. They're different. I paid a tip this morning when I got a coffee. I based it on the amount of tax I got. It was a measure. It wasn't repayment of the tax. I didn't pay tax twice. Neither has Chrysler in this instance. Additionally, there is no over-collection of tax for a number of reasons. First of all, because the tax has only been paid once. And secondly, because, as Mr. Larson points out, 372.025 requires an adjustment of gross receipts by the retailer when a return is made to a retailer. That is specific. Canons of statutory construction in this state require that when you have a specific statute, it overrules the general statute. So here, 372.025 is going to trump 372.065.
So there's a conflict.
There's clearly a conflict for his client in that 372.025 uses the term retailer. It requires retailer to be part of the return transaction under 372.025. Chrysler has stipulated all along he's not a retailer in the state of Nevada. It's not registered as such. Doesn't remit taxes as such.
They're arguing they're the person that bore the burden of the tax.
Sure, and that's absolutely, and that's where the differentiation between specific and general language comes in, because the person who bore the tax is a general term of art, whereas retailer is a specific term of art defined within the Nevada revised statutes. That specificity is what specifically excludes Chrysler from being able to utilize 372.025. Additionally, with regard to every state that has ruled on this issue, they have all ruled in the same way that Connecticut and Maine and Pennsylvania have all ruled. In line with the statutes that Nevada has, I request that this state or this court similarly rule. And lastly, there is no punitive
amount here. There is no punitive tax. The fact that a manufacturer may experience some financial discomfort as a result of the minimum law is inconsequential, said the Supreme Court, or said the tax court in Indiana. The financial discomfort is intended for a reason. It provides incentive or teeth for manufacturers to improve the quality of the product. That does not make punitive a statute. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate your time.
All right, Mr. Bodger, Mr. Larson, we greatly appreciate your input and your excellent arguments this morning and your briefing in this matter.